This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Let's try really hard not to have another great recession again, because that really sucked.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. You're at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now please welcome my special guest for this week, Megan Kufeld. Megan, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, Megan is a research scientist at the Northwest Evaluation Association, also known as NWEA, also known as the nonprofit that has the Measures of Academic Progress exam, the MAP, which kids all over the country enjoy taking, including my own sons in Montgomery County, Maryland, who get to take that test 3 times a year and do not complain about it as much as they complain about the big state test at the end of the year. Welcome to the show. Great to have you here. We are going to be talking about a new study about kindergarten readiness. So let's do that on Ed Reform Update. All right. So, Megan, you've got this new paper. It's called Trends in Children's Academic Skills at School Entry, 2010 to 2017. Megan was the lead author on that paper. It caught our attention here because, you know, we are getting ready for the National Assessment of Educational Progress results to come out in just a couple of weeks. And here, lo and behold, I didn't realize that we had a good national measure of kindergarten readiness skills that can give us some context, perhaps, for the fourth grade and eighth grade and 12th grade scores that we're used to seeing from NAEP. So tell us, how the heck do we know how kindergartners are doing and how are they doing?
Like you said, we have a measure here at NWA called the MAP Growth Assessment, and we evaluate students both all the way from kindergarten through high school using this assessment. And so we kind of realized when we were starting this paper that kindergarten readiness is something that's a little bit harder to study than other grades because we don't have standardized testing in most states until third grade. But we have this pretty large sample of students who take MAP Growth across the country. Back in 2010, it was about 80,000 students who were taking the test. Then up to more recent years, it's around 450,000 students in 2017 taking the kindergarten assessment. So we're able to track across each school year, each incoming kindergarten cohort from 2010 to 2017 to learn about their math and reading skills. And what we see is that...
Well, before we get into the results, let me just ask a couple questions.
Sure.
First of all, for people listening, they say, wait a minute, a kindergarten test? I mean, you know, these are tiny little kiddos. They can't even read yet for the most part. Can you kids kind of describe like what might the reading and math questions on a kindergarten assessment even look like?
Yeah, so that's a really good point that most kids, you know, at this age aren't reading. So this assessment is audio supported. So the questions are read out loud to them. And there's a lot of interactiveness to the test. So it doesn't look like the same kind of standardized test you would imagine a third grader or older to be taking. It's made to be a little bit more interactive and fun, and it's usually done on a tablet or a computer. And they're typically assessing pretty, you know, in many states, the Common Core standards, and other states, the state standards that are appropriate for that for kindergarten. So it's a lot of kind of early shapes and identification of different shapes and adding and subtract, you know, very basic adding and subtracting skills in math. And then in reading, it's much more about phonics and other things that are kind of the building blocks of learning to read in those grades.
All right. No, that's interesting. And so it sounds like almost more like what you might see, like almost like a little computer game for the kids. Here's the other big question is, you know, you are now used in lots of places, as you said, over 400,000 kindergartners taking your test. That sounds to me like it's more than what, probably more than 10% of all kindergartners in the country. How do you think about this being nationally representative? Did you have some mechanism for that?
It is, like you said, it is a pretty large sample, but it's not a random sample like we would see with NAEP or with the ECLSK studies. So we produced a set of national weights to compare our sample of schools, because we have a lot of school information that we can compare to the national sample of public schools that serve kindergarten. So in the study, we report both weighted and unweighted estimates to try to account for the fact that while large, our sample isn't purely nationally representative.
Okay, now with that out of the way, tell us the results. How are those kindergarten kids doing?
Drum roll. So the results show that our kindergarten students who are entering between 2010 and 2014 show pretty flat skill levels. So there's not much difference between the math and reading skills of incoming kindergartners during that time. But between 2014 and 2017, we actually see a slight dip in the skills. So kids in 2017 are actually testing a little bit lower in both math and reading when they enter kindergarten than they were in 2014.
Is there any way to look at this by subgroup? I mean, we always worry with the NAEP results that, you know, it could be the cohort effects. You've got more and more Hispanic kids in the sample than before, and they tend to be lower performing, for example, than white kids. I mean, is that an issue, or are we looking at something else?
We do look at the subgroups in the paper. So we actually show that, you know, when you break it out by race ethnicity, so white students versus black students and white students versus Hispanic students, we actually see a bit of a narrowing in the gaps, even though both groups are showing these slight declines. The groups are actually coming together a little bit by about 0.1 standard deviations between 2010 to 2017.
But it is across the groups. So look, it's hard to say that there's any good news here, right? I mean, this is pretty depressing that we see scores heading downward. So do you want to hear my theory on this?
Sure.
You know, I look at the timing of this and it seems very interesting to me. I have floated this hypothesis this summer, looking at NAEP results over time, that saying that it really seems like when you see a big shift in the economic situation of the country and child poverty rates, especially, as we would see with the onset of the Great Recession and its aftermath, that it seems like the cohort of kids born either when things start going really bad or maybe when they start going really good, like they did in the late 90s, you really seem to see this inflection point for the kids born around that time. And lo and behold, you're seeing that kindergartners in 2014 start to show these declines. And those were kids that were born in 2009, you know, right in the aftermath of the Great Recession. So I guess the question is, if is this maybe some evidence that what we're seeing with these declines is perhaps, again, the aftermath of the Great Recession? That recession's over, but the impacts are going to still linger with us as kids make their way through school. Does that make some sense from your perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely one of the theories that to me makes a lot of sense. And it's definitely something that we tried to look into a little bit by looking at differences across schools that are in low and high poverty to see whether or not the kind of poverty, at least at the time of testing, was a big impact. But it didn't really seem to explain a lot of the trends. But we do see that these by poverty gaps are narrowing a teeny bit. Whether or not that explains the overall downward trend, I think, you know, the inflection point definitely seems to come to when you're talking about when those kids would have been born into it. But it's definitely hard to have causal explanations with this kind of descriptive data.
Yeah. Now, you know, again, like I said at the top, we're getting ready for the NAEP results to come out. And interestingly, those kids that were born in 2009, kindergartners in 2014, some of them were fourth graders in 2019, in this past spring. So, you know, my concern is that we're going to see perhaps some declines at the fourth grade level on NAEP, and that could stay with us for a while, again, all because of the aftermath of the Great Recession, which would indicate that, you know, if we now have a measure of how kids are doing at the beginning of school. We can try to kind of control for that as we think about the impact schools can have that. We do see some declines in fourth grade. It's not necessarily because schools are doing worse. It's because kids started coming into school with fewer skills than before. And so it's almost like we have to try to control for that, almost like you can with your growth studies. When you're looking at these kinds of trends, I guess if you were able to look at the kindergarten readiness skills and based on what you know from your other research, would you predict that kids that start with lower skills, that means that as they make their way through the school system, they're going to tend to have those lower skills all along?
It's really interesting. We see kind of two patterns with our data. One, we see in kindergarten, the kids who start out with lower skills tend to grow more in kindergarten than the kids who start out with higher skills. So there's actually a negative correlation between being a kind of a lower skilled student at entry and growth. So that's encouraging. But what we also see is that the kids who start out low are often the kids who end up low by later grades as well. That kind of there's a pretty strong correlation between where you enter and where you end up in terms of your kind of rank ordering and academic skills. So yep. Kind of a good news, bad news situation.
All right. Well, hey, and look, the one bit of good news here, I would say, is if this is showing the lingering effects of the Great Recession, the good news is we now have an economy that's booming. We have poverty rates that are declining. So here's hoping that this was a problem that was relatively short-lived. And hey, let's try really hard not to have another Great Recession again, because that really sucked. And it looks like it really had potentially a negative impact on kids. And so, you know, good for us to be reminded of that. We, those of us involved in education, you know, we try to focus on things that we can control, like what's going on in schools. But of course, these other things have a big impact at the same time. Well, hey, really appreciate you joining us again. It was Megan Hufeld at the Northwest Evaluation Association. You can check out Trends in Children's Academic Skills at School Entry 2010 and 2017. Hope you guys keep doing research like this. It's super helpful.
Great. We appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks so much. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Adam Tyner, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be here, Mike.
Been a little bit since you've been in the Research Minute spot in lieu of Amber. Great to have you here. What you got for us this week?
Well, today we have a study that it could be a little controversial. David might need a hug by the end of this, Mike, so be ready for that.
I'm always happy to hug David.
The study is a little different than a typical study we review on the Research Minute because it's actually a meta-analysis. But I thought we should discuss it because it has pretty important implications for equity in the education system, the validity of standardized tests, and for teacher preparation too. The study is by researchers at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. It's forthcoming in the Journal of Applied Psychology, and it's entitled Stereotype Threat Effects in Settings with Features Likely versus Unlikely in Operational Test Settings. I know you're going to hate that title.
Can we work with scholars on their titles? I mean, come on, people. It's not hard. It's really not.
This one could have used some punctuation, I think.
Yeah, at the least.
In any case, I do want to remind readers what a meta-analysis is. In this type of study, the researchers compile the results of many previous studies to see what the research is saying overall. But it's more technical than just a review. What's especially powerful with meta-analysis is that the results of each study are weighted based on how certain the authors of the studies are that there really is an effect. Mm-hmm. Then the people conducting the meta-analysis can put more stock in studies with stronger results and less weight on studies where the results were relatively ambiguous.
Yeah.
So in this study—
And also, let's remind listeners about what stereotype threat is.
Yeah. So in this study, the researchers analyzed the results of 212 lab experiments of the effect of stereotype threat on test scores. Now, stereotype threat, as you were saying, Mike, is when people feel like they might be conforming to negative stereotypes about a group that they're in, for example, their race or gender. There have been a lot of studies that show that, for example, telling female students that females generally perform worse on the following test before giving them that test makes them do worse than if you just have them take the test without priming them like that. So that's what stereotype threat is. Now to the findings. The researchers find that the effects of stereotype threat are much lower or even non-existent under conditions that are most realistic for actual students, and that the best studies, for example, those with the largest sample sizes, had the smallest effects to the extent of null effects in some cases. So that idea about telling students before they take a test that their group generally underperforms on that type of test, and no actual teacher would ever do that. And then we're practical scenario where, for example, a student fills out some demographic information about themselves before taking a test has, at worst, a very small effect. They also looked at the effect of stereotype threat in higher stakes environments where we would practically be the most worried that stereotype threat could invalidate the results of tests, for example, if it happened on the SAT or something. When they looked at studies where participants were given cash incentives for performance on the test, which obviously makes participants take the experiment more seriously, there was no clear effect of stereotype threat at all. The researchers conclude that the burden of proof should shift to those who think that stereotype threat has any substantial effect on standardized test takers, although, of course, the implications of this research go well beyond just standardized tests.
Wow. No, this is a big deal. I mean, on the one hand, it's good in that it gives us more confidence in what we're seeing on the tests. I guess the bad news is, you know, when we see big achievement gaps, for example, racial achievement gaps, in some cases gender, certainly socioeconomic, we can't blame it on stereotype threat, you know, which would be kind of an easy thing to fix.
That's right.
Right. It seems to be, you know, basically measuring something that's much more fundamental and probably harder for us to have an impact on. Of course, that's what we talk about here in the Research Minute all the time, is how we can have an impact on those sorts of things.
Adam, did you have any critiques of the meta-analysis, or did you basically buy it?
Well, there are some decisions that are made about which studies to include and which to exclude. And so, I mean, they're talking about the studies that are most like real life scenarios. And so they have some different decisions about that. And I don't know if everybody would treat those the same way that they did. For example, one of them was that had to do with the way that they graded the tests. And it seemed a little bit arbitrary to me, which you could pick. I think you could plausibly pick either way of grading the tests. But anyway, I didn't have any strong feeling that they were excluding something that was really important, but they did make some decisions that actually impacted the results that I think other people might have a different take on.
And I assume that some of these findings have been known for a while, for example, about demographic information maybe having some slight effect. So I don't most tests now ask for that at the end instead of at the beginning as standard practice for that reason?
Right. I think that's right.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true, but I mean, in any event, it seems like, I don't know. I mean, you get asked that all the time, speaking from a place of privilege here, but that would, that's when I just do that as a rote thing, right? It's not the same thing as somebody coming in and saying, so this is going to be test of your, I don't know.
But here's the bigger question though, is if some of this stuff is just in the culture, right? I mean, if you, let's say we're talking about racial, you know, stereotype threat, there's a lot of talk. We talk about it. Maybe we're in a bubble here, but you know, about achievement gaps and about the fact that African-American kids on average do worse on tests than white kids do. It's not like that's a secret out there. I'm sure kids are hearing it. It's in the pop culture. It's sort of, how do you take that into account? That stuff that seems to be out there. No, it's not as direct as the teacher a minute before the test saying, hey, just to remind everybody,
right,
African-American kids usually don't do very well in these kinds of tests.
I think it's a really good point, Mike. I mean, I think the upshot here isn't that the stereotype research isn't important or that there's not broader implications that are still, you know, likely valid, but it's just that, I mean, stereotype threat could be explaining some of the broader phenomenon where we see different groups pursuing different academic and career paths, or, you know, by the same token, the research on having a mentor or a teacher from the same group and that how that tends to boost performance for underrepresented groups that may be stereotyped negatively could be kind of the opposite effect, where you see, have an example of somebody who defies a stereotype and then it kind of changes your perception. So I don't think that like the broader implications are necessarily bad, but the implications for standardized tests and for practice in the classroom, I think there are some implications there. And I think a lot of ed schools are really focusing on this kind of thing, but it's not really clear that in the classroom, there's a lot that teachers should be doing differently.
All right, we'll leave it there. Well done, Adam. Thanks for bringing us. And hey, I do like it, having these meta-analyses every once in a while.
We'll talk about that, Mike.
Yeah, all right. All right. Okay, we'll talk about it offline, because once again, we are out of time. Until next week.
I'm David Griffin.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.